Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. Hard to believe, 8 weeks already into our fourth annual franchise legal series. Really extraordinary time on Franchise Today in this fourth event. You know, we led off with Michael Leopold, followed by Lee Clave, both of Clave Cook. Amy Chang talked about private equity and franchising from Chang Cohen. Barry Heller from DLA Piper enlightened us on the world of franchisor litigation. Mark Kirsch from Great Plant Moody and I discussed outsourcing franchise sales and dealing with outsourced franchise sales organizations, including brokers. Lane Fisher from Fisher Zucker was on. We talked about financial performance representations. It was really a fascinating show. Then, of course, last week from Redgrave LLP was Jonathan Redgrave, an information law specialist. We talked about e-discovery. And then today we'll be wrapping up with our IFA Legal Symposium recap with the IFA's Dean Heil. But before we get to the meat of today's program, I'd like to introduce Steve Olson, the president of the Franchise Update Media Group, to tell us a little bit about the upcoming Franchise Consumer Marketing Conference. But before we do that, I'd like to add, you know, and remind everybody the Franchise Update Media Group is a strategic partner of Franchise Today, and we really look to have a long relationship with them as we have done with Fishman Public Relation and Elements Local. So, Steve, welcome to Franchise Today.
Well, thank you, and appreciate Paul, and look forward to our burgeoning relationship we'll have with you as a strategic partner. This conference we're talking about, I mean, let's face it, today's CMOs carry the most challenging executive position in franchising. And when you do think about it, I mean, they must identify and attract their consumer audiences, build a brand, drive more customers, and as we all know, help their franchisees be more profitable. And to do this, it's a tremendous load. They must be experts in traditional and digital technologies, brand reputation, and very importantly, convince their CEOs, or I should say your CEOs, ops, technology, and other teams to support the programs for the benefit of the franchisees. So this June, we're putting on our third annual Franchise Update Franchise Consumer Marketing Conference, and we currently have close to 150 CMOs and CEOs and tech people that have been signed up for this, and so we feel that we'll bust through that and probably end up with about 160 franchisors as well as business service suppliers. This conference is going to be held in Atlanta on June 25th, as I had mentioned. It's going to be led by our board of 15 veteran CMOs from service, food, and retail brands. And just to name what types of companies are coming, our board leaders are from Massage Envy, Sears, Sylvan Learning Centers, Denny's, Jersey Mike's, Moe's Southwest Grill, Kitty Academy, Great Clips, Annie Ann's, Bright Star Care, Hungry Howie's, Interim Healthcare, Checkers, and CertaPro. So you can see we have quite an illustrious list. Our theme this year will be Own Your Audience, which is going to drill deep and features three-hour boot camps. And we'll have 14 interactive workshops that are going to be led by experienced CMOs and CEOs, again, from retail, service, and food. This also includes four keynotes that we're going to have, which are renowned experts who have worked with such organizations as Starbucks, Whole Foods, AT&T, and executives from Google, and those that have worked with Yahoo and other household brands. So for those of you that haven't registered yet that are interested, go to franchiseconsumermarketing.com and check out our agenda. And appreciate that again. That's franchiseconsumermarketing.com, and we hope to see you next month.
Sounds great, Paul? Steve. I certainly look forward to being there and participating. I'm real anxious also to meet one of the keynotes, Eric Qualman, who I'm a big fan of, and I've mentioned numerous times on this show. Steve, I appreciate you being with us today and also being a strategic partner of Franchise Today. Thank you. So today, as I said, we are talking about the IFA Legal Symposium recap that occurred in Washington, D.C. on May 7th, 2013. It was at the JW Marriott. And my guest today is Dean Heil. Dean is definitely a veteran lobbyist. His position with the IFA is at Senior Director, State Government Relations, Public Policy, and Tax Council. He's an attorney and expert on issues impacting franchise businesses. He comes to the IFA from the Direct Selling Association, where he was Director of Government Relations in addition to serving as an attorney for the association for almost 9 years. In that capacity, he was responsible for lobbying at the local, state, and federal level, providing legal analysis, liaison activities with Republican and Democrat related organizations. Really comes to us with a wealth of experience. Dean, welcome to Franchise Today.
Thank you much, Paul.
You know, I'll tell you, there's so much changing in franchising, and of course, the legal aspect and perspective of it certainly doesn't make it any less challenging, as exhibited by your seven counterparts through the legal series, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show. And it just makes many of our listeners just shake with bewilderment as to all the different things that they have to know about in today's day and age. And I know that at the Legal Symposium, we've even expanded that a great deal, looking at the IFA's, at the PowerPoint from the Legal Symposium. I look at the slide on government relations and public policy and the federal priorities of healthcare, immigration reform, workforce policy, tax reform, small business lending. And as you might know, we had Steve Caldera on Franchise Today, back to our Voices of Franchising series in February, and he discussed various items within those very issues. So I think that the one that is probably the most mainstream is with respect to health care and the Affordable Care Act and the employer mandate. If you would, give us a little bit of insight into what that means for franchise organizations, franchisees, and small business owners in general.
Well, you know, thank you, Paul, on that. It is probably between that issue and franchise relationship legislation, probably the single two main issues that we focus on, if you will. We toggle between the two. The healthcare issue is so important, especially for those franchises that have more than 50 employees and providing the health insurance for them. In addition to the federal mandate, you know, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, however you want to call it, we're also starting to see it's called the cascade effect on state legislation as well. We have California Assembly Bill 880 dealing with Medi-Cal. We have the Connecticut bill as well dealing with Husky Care is what they call it. And it's something that all franchisees and franchisors need to be aware about, because it affects their bottom line so much, and especially with some of these franchisees who are operating on such razor-thin margins already, this could really be a make-or-break type issue for them. And that's why IFA is putting so much focus on those issues.
Sure. Well, the Affordable Care Act, under the employer mandate, says large employers must offer affordable health insurance of a minimum value to full-time employees and their dependents, or face tax penalties. And if you would, give us some insight into what that actually means.
Well, the tax penalties, and it's a good question, because there's still a lot of unknowns out there. But the main thing is that you're looking at potentially a $2,000 hit per every non-covered employee. And that's just to distill it down to its most simple terms. Is if you have employees that need to be covered, and if you're not providing that insurance, that's what you're looking at, is a $2,000 hit per employee.
And what could the potential tax ramifications be?
Well, you know, the tax ramifications, and this is where it's classified as a tax, you know, that some people call it a penalty, but after the U.S. Supreme Court, it was determined that this is not a penalty, it's a tax, you know, so whether mm-hmm. whether you want to call it a penalty or the tax, the net effect is the same. And so if some folks want to call it a $2,000 penalty, that's fine. It's going to cost them just the same as if it was a $2,000 tax per employee.
Okay, and is $2,000 the figure that's being thrown around?
Yes, that is the amount.
And is that $2,000 just one-time fee? Is this something that occurs every year? Is it?
It would be an every year. It would be
really.
Yes, Paul. That you hit it on the head. It's not just a one-time pay it and you're done. It is an ongoing penalty / tax, if you will.
So, and I guess we could probably have a whole nother show as to where those taxes or fines would go. Time for that today. But I know the IFA mentions on their website, you know, myth versus fact, and it's at makingsenseofhealthcare.org.
Yep.
And I'd highly recommend people visit that site and learn a little bit more because, obviously, this is a key issue. I don't think there's something that can be hidden behind, unless, Dean, you can tell us otherwise. I think it's something that's here. It's now. It's real, right?
And you hit on something, Paul. This is something that it's not going away. It is here. It is in force. You know, so many people are saying, oh, when does it take effect? It has taken effect, and it's And I think that's the main message that we need to get out there. And also the political reality is that it is not going to go away anytime soon. And we just need to, you know, live with it and move on. Adapt and adopt, as they would say.
Well, you know, the cynical part of me and maybe the sarcastic part of me wants to point out that you might have just come up with a new oxymoron as political reality. So that's probably another whole conversation for another day. You know, as Steve Caldera mentioned when he was on the show about workforce policy, you know, we know the IFA is working to prevent new rulings and legislation that would create additional uncertainty in the workplace for franchise business owners and hurt, basically, you know, both small business owners, franchisees, and their employees. Where do we stand on that? What's coming down the pipe? What do we need to know with respect to workforce policy?
Well, the main thing that I focus on with workforce policy and something that affects franchisors and franchisees is the independent contractor status of the franchisee. We have in about 28 states, they use this test called the ABC test. It's a three-part test, and it doesn't really lend itself to this program, the in-depth nature of it. But what it is it's a test that normally works fairly well for independent contractors, but due to the unique relationship that franchisees have with franchisors, it really clouds the issue of whether or not a franchisee is an independent contractor. And if you look back to last year's law was a bill in Georgia, IFA pushed for a piece of legislation that said, look, if you're a franchisee under the terms of the FTC franchise agreement, you are an independent contractor. And I'm also happy to say that in Delaware this year, House Bill 55, it is now on the governor's desk, and maybe he's even signed it between now and when I last checked, a similar bill that will clarify the independent contractor status of franchisees. In Washington State earlier this year, we had a bill that would not only create a presumption of employee status of workers, but they would use the ABC test. So it was a doubly bad bill in that you had the aspect of creating that presumption that an individual was an employee, and then the only way you could get out of that presumption was using an ABC test, as I just mentioned, which is a flawed test for franchisees. So that's what our main focus is. is protecting that independent contractor status of the franchisees.
You know, the National Labor Relations Board had various rulings. I know from the slides is the ambush election rules, specialty health care, micro-unions, employee rights, postal requirement, U.S. Department of Labor, persuader rule. Give us a breakdown, a quick breakdown on each of those and what we can expect.
Well, sure. You know, the IFA is part of the Coalition for a Democratic Workforce, and we, along with a large group, led the charge on not only the validity of the NLRB decision, the Canning decision, but also with the appointments of some of the individuals on that board. So that's the main focus that we've been addressing is some of the overreaches by the NLRB. Now, we're also very concerned about the Department of Labor. There's been some rumblings about independent contractor status. Once again, that is something that keeps coming up of franchisees, and we're on that. And but what I'd like to say is we really take a holistic view between just the interaction between state and federal aspects. So that's probably the most in-depth I can go into the whole workforce and what we're doing with NLRB and the Department of Labor. And then also I'd like to say the individual states' Department of Labor. We have almost 1,300 franchisors, and we get reports on a fairly regular basis of the individual state departments of labor looking into the way they operate. And so far, you know, all of our folks have, it's been fine, but, you know, it's something that we're very concerned about, of protecting that independent contractor status of franchisees.
You know, Dean, I know this was the 46th annual legal symposium. It's hard to believe. That's a lot of years, a lot of events. What was the tone of the audience? What was the sentiment? What was the makeup of the audience for this year's event?
Oh, I think positive is what I would say, or kind of seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, hopefully, as far as the bad economic situation that we've seen. You know, we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. We're not there yet, and there certainly will be obstacles, but I think, you know, one of the things that's been great about franchising is how resilient it has been, even despite the poor economic conditions that we've faced. I think now what a lot of the folks were talking about, and maybe it's a little centric on my part doing so much with the states, is just being really concerned about some of the state legislation. I often kid my colleagues who handle federal work, it's like being run over by a glacier. You know, the issues on the federal level are very big, but they're slow moving. I mean, they obviously have much more, their scope is much wider on the federal level, but they move at such a slow rate. Now, on the states, I often say I have a shot clock of sometimes 2 months for legislation being introduced and passed into law. And with 50 separate governmental entities, our governmental units out there, or 51 including Puerto Rico, that we focus on, that is a compliance issue that a lot of our companies are really concerned about. And also, the implications. Take, for example, California, where it is, depending on who you talk to, if it was its own economy, would be the eighth largest in the world. But then we also have the precedential effect of even legislation, you know, passing like in Minnesota or what have you. So I think the tone was upbeat. I think the folks really got a lot out of the programming itself. But I think there's also a lot of concern out there of what's happening, both on the federal and state levels. But, you know, my fort, if I have one, is working on the state government relations aspects.
Any key moments or highlights you'd like to share from any of the keynote speakers?
Well, I think our opening session where we had franchisees and also a franchisor perspective the moderated panel was very interesting. I think folks, Aziz and Ken gave a great presentation, and then the moderator did a great job as well of this talking about how franchisees and franchisors, their perspectives on you know, the issues that develop, and also how the franchise systems work. I thought that was a very good start. I think also the other issues out there, we had a great program of information. We had, you know, 19 different sessions, I believe, or 20 sessions. I might have misspoken. 19 or 20 of them. And I think people, from all the reports, I think we had around like a 97%. It was if you had to give us a grade, around in that neighborhood. So I think people got a lot out of it. And then the session that my boss and I gave, Judith Thorman, as we discussed, she spoke on most of the federal issues, and then I spoke on the state government relations issues as well. I think we were able to get a lot of information to a lot of folks.
Well, as is typically the case with the IFA, I'm sure the conference, the event was a very great success, and I'm sure it was well received by all, as you said, by a 97% rating. And as you said about the federal government being like a glacier that moves slowly, again, I have to think back with a little bit of chuckle and also say, well, we know icebergs break off glaciers, and what's below the surface is far greater than what we see at the top of the surface. And I guess in that analogy, maybe it scares us a little bit because of what we might not be able to see. But what we can see certainly are things coming down the pipe with respect to, you know, rising costs for franchisees and small business owners alike. One of the key areas that I know is going up is the raising of the minimum wage. When does that take effect? How has it taken effect? Has it already taken effect? Enlighten us a bit.
Yeah, and Paul, that will be taking effect soon. I'm not 100% sure of all the specific dates on that on the federal level. I can tell you that there's many states that are looking at raising the minimum wage issues. On the federal issue, I just don't have those facts and figures in front of me right now.
No problem. I know Obama's State of the Union initiative was raising it to $9, and then I think there was legislation to raise it to $10.10 an hour. It's this is something that really, you know, looking at the PowerPoint presentation from a state legislature standpoint, 206 different wage and hour bills introduced in 2013 alone. Wow.
And what's amazing, Paul, is that some of these it's not just states, but we're seeing individual cities having $15 an hour minimum wage ordinances coming up. And,
wow,
you know, that's something that obviously concerns a lot of our folks.
Well, I think where a big concern also lies is that it's not so much that that's just a minimum wage, it's that what they now have to do with all the other employees, if you raise it to $15, the ones that have been sitting there making $12 and $13, you know, you can't just take them up to minimum wage. They're going to expect to go up to $18 and $19 an hour. So it really is a ripple domino effect.
Yeah, it's the, you know, your operating cost. And like I said before, if you're running on a small margin, every dollar counts.
Absolutely. And, of course, you know, when we talk about minimum wage, it used to be we were thinking about, you know, a lot of the teenagers in the younger part of the workforce taking summer jobs and part-time jobs and what have you. And, of course, over the last few years in particular, but we've been seeing this trend move on. We have more immigrants coming into the country, getting involved in the workforce at mostly a lower wage. But, you know, taking these jobs as full-time positions. I know we had on the show Dave Melton, the multi-unit franchise operator for Domino's, and he has a book out called Hiring the American Dream, and built an entire workforce, as you could imagine, in the pizza industry. industry around minimum wage employees, and now immigration obviously is a big component. And we have, you know, immigration reform that's out there. Give us some insight into immigration reform and how it's going to affect franchising moving forward.
Well, sure, you know, and that's something that IFA has been a leader on with the immigration reform, and something needs to be done. You know, that's just the fact of it is that we have more jobs in some areas than we have people, and we need to get those people connected with those jobs. I mean, that's how franchises, other businesses need, you know, they're run on people. If you don't have people, your business does not work. One of the other things I'd like to address is on the minimum wage issue, and then we can go back to the immigration, is that minimum wage jobs for many people are their first-time jobs. It's what gets them into the workforce. And just because you have a minimum wage job, hopefully you will not stay there, but it will get you the foot in the door that you need to become part of the grid, if you will, of working in society. And so that's why these entry-level paid positions are so important for people just to get, you know, it's like if you're going onto the interstate, these are the on-ramp jobs to get you onto the road. And so that's one of the things that we keep, you know, pushing again and again of why – you know, these jobs are important. They're good jobs. People are doing things. They're getting paid. They're getting involved with their communities, and they're getting into the workforce. And many times that's their first job. So,
I guess the thing that concerns me, and I know others probably share the same sentiment, is that we have such a growing young population that's unemployed and underemployed, but even going back to, as you said, for their first job. More and more teenagers are having a hard time finding that first job. And a big part of that is because you have a lot of immigrants, a lot of people taking that entry-level job and that space in the workforce. And, of course, from a small business owner standpoint, you know, they look at it and say, if I could pay this guy, and let's say the minimum wage is $11, if I could pay this guy $11 and he's raising a family, and I know I can depend upon him, and he's probably going to look at this long term, might be more apt to make an investment and hire that person as opposed to this teenager coming on that might only be with me for 3 to 6 months or a year or whatever until they go to school and move on. And that's troubling to think about because I really think, you know, obviously the youngsters that are out there, it's important for them to get involved in the business early. It sets the tone for their future. I know throughout franchising, we have all kinds of stories of individuals that started at their organizations in an entry-level position and now are in C-level positions or actually as franchisees or even as the franchisor founder. So, you know, I guess, and this is just my little editorial, if you will, I mean, we really need to be focusing on that younger crowd, and I know organizations like DECA, I know Steve Greenbaum, CEO at the Postnet, and Undercover Boss fame, recently was a keynote speaker at the DECA event, and he really shares some a great experience, you know, talking in front of thousands of people at their annual event. And hats off to Steve, and if you have an opportunity, all your listeners, to have Steve share that story with you, by all means, you will really see the pride as well as the humility shine through in his voice and his eyes. We are on Franchise Today. We're in the last segment of an 8-part fourth annual franchise legal series. My guest today is Dean Heil, Senior Director, State Government Relations, Public Policy, and Tax Counsel of the IFA. God, Dean, how do you get that all on your business card?
it's a small font, but it, no, it does all fit, and I appreciate the long title because I'm fortunate that I do get to cover so many different issues and doing all the state government, you know, it's this government relations, but it's also the public policy aspect of trying to, you know, have good public policy that benefits not just the franchise industry, but consumers as a whole. And then also the tax counsel aspect of my work, which is a huge portion of how franchisors, such as sales reporting, we have Nexus issues, we have all these other different issues out there. We spent quite a bit of time talking about the Health Care Act and that tax that is what this one of many that our franchise folks face. So, but it's a broad portfolio. We've had a very busy year. I thought last year was busy. I started at IFA during the middle of the last legislative session, and then we've more than surpassed that this year with different bills that have come up that we've had to deal with both proactively and then also in a more reactive, defensive type position to protect the industry. So.
You know, I loved your comment about immigration reform, and I really think you need to take it as a platform when you throw your head into the ring to run for president in 2016, because I'll vote for you, because a platform of something has to be done, I believe, is just as eloquently spoken and so concise and to the point out of anything that I've ever heard. You're right. Something has to be done. And I think that's key. It's not something we can continue to put our head in the sand about, because as I often say, when you put your head in the sand, your most vulnerable asset is popped up for the world to see.
Yeah.
E-Verify, I mean, obviously, is something that, is a must. I know, having done a lot of work in and around the commercial cleaning industry, which, of course, has its own stigma now with what went on with Massachusetts, and we'll get you to talk a little bit about that as we move forward. But, you know, having spent some time in there, and of course, you have a lot of immigrant workers in there, and the varying documents that they can provide to show whether they're legal or not is just ridiculous. So I'm really happy to see this E-Verify program, whereas a lot of people don't know that the Electronic Employment Verification Program, I really think was a necessary step to streamlining that entire process.
Well, and that's something you hit upon, Paul, is that my background, you know, prior to coming to IFA is with the Direct Selling Association, and there's currently 16 million people every year sell from Avon to Mary Kay, Amway, Kirby Vacuum Cleaners, you name it. There's over 200 companies within the Direct Selling Association, of which, 16 million people selling products. And all of those folks are independent contractors. And
sure,
when it comes up with E-Verify, what I'm always concerned about is the potential liability that folks that utilize independent contractors, any liability that they would have. But let's take a look at the franchisees. You have individuals, if they provide a false Social Security number and you run it through E-Verify, they could provide you a number that E-Verify would check off that would say that it's valid, but you don't know. There's nothing that shows that the documentation that it could be a false number. And what I'm always concerned about is our franchisees, the potential liability they have when they're given false information. And I think that's something that
sure,
we really need to be focused in on, is that protecting people who, if you take somebody at their word and you do due diligence, there should be something that protects you from, any liability out there. And that's something that's very concerning to me. And it's also, something that pops up on the state level. I mean, I understand completely about having people verified, making sure that they're in the country legally, and that aspect. However, where the concern comes is if you go too far to the extreme end. I remember a couple years back, we had a bill in Wyoming where they wanted to E-Verify independent contractors. I contacted the Department of Homeland Security, and they said, Dean, you can't E-Verify independent contractors. The system is not set up. It's only set up to go for employees. So when I testified on the bill, I said, the only thing I like about this bill is the sponsor, because I've known him for years. Everything else about this bill, I couldn't comply with it even if I wanted to. And so that's where we have to, keep our focus in. And when we do draft these bills and this legislation, we kind of have to run it through beyond this, the theoretical aspects of it, but kind of do some deep thinking of this, well, let's run at the next step. I often tell folks when we have legislation, we have to think in terms of chess, not checkers, as far as what will be happening down the road. And so,
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely couldn't agree more. And I think, I think back to during a consulting gig with a major commercial cleaning company, dealing with one of their master franchisees that had difficulty in one of the major oil companies' sites with workers that were in there that had gotten through Homeland Security check, but then when they did an audit of the actual documents, actually found with very, very, very close scrutiny that some of the documents weren't quote-unquote legal documents. And the master franchisee lost a very significant, substantial account because of it. And it really raised my eyebrow because it was, okay, you know, do they need to be documents experts? Because I looked at the documents. They looked fine to me. That's a whole other story. So hopefully as the process gets streamlined, some of that will obviously be rectified.
Well, and that's what I was getting at, Paul, exactly, with the good faith. If you, as an employer, operating at good faith, take in these documents and due diligence, there should be, you know, limit, you know, there should be an out for you from liability on that, because you're in the business of selling stuff, not in the business of being a document expert. And so,
absolutely. Which leads us to... this topic that a lot of people just cringe about, tax reform. I know there's, you know, bipartisan political drivers, there's partisan differences. Because we only have 24 minutes left in the show, kind of give us an overview on the whole tax reform issue.
Well, you know, the IFA's, you know, has been very clear that the tax reform, anything that comes about, should not be borne by the individual taxpayers themselves, because so many of it, IFA represents both franchisees and franchisors. We represent the corporations, and we also represent the franchisees, the individual out there that operate the business. And many of these folks are S-Corps, and their returns go through themselves. You know, it's an individual return that comes on. You know, you have your business, you run it through an S-Corp, and then that profit is put onto your individual return. I think with the limited amount of time that we have, as you stated, the main thing that we want to address is that any tax reform, that whatever happens is that the individuals don't bear the brunt of any of that reform, and that's what we're very concerned about.
Sure, absolutely. And like you said, and like I said, certainly we could spend an entire segment of Franchise Today on tax reform, and we might just do that come September, when we're going to focus everything around the IFA's Public Affairs Conference and issues thereabout. And then another big topic, obviously, continues to be small business lending. I'm happy to see that in 2013, lending to franchises will reach its highest level since the recession, I should say, but it still represents a big lending gap. So how was this incorporated into the legal symposium with respect to small business lending?
Well, the main point that was discussed is that, look, you know, without, you know, cash is what drives the liquidity that's needed, is what drives growth. And without that liquidity, franchising has suffered because we haven't been able to get the funds that our franchisees and also some of our franchisors need to expand. And so that was the gist of the discussions. You know, obviously it's an overbroad, and as you would say, we could have a whole different program just on the small business lending aspect.
Oh, sure.
Of that. But the gist of it is that more money is needed for folks, franchisees and franchisors alike. I'd like to go back to this one point that we're talking about, the Fair Minimum Wage Act. Looking at my notes here, just for the listeners, it would raise the minimum wage of $7.25 to $10.10 per hour by 2015. That's what would happen. Just wanted to give you an update on that.
Thanks. I appreciate that. And of course, with respect to small business lending, we've had on the show Daryl Johnson of Frandata and Ronald Feldman of Franchise America Finance and the Siegel Capital Group. And, you know, it really does come down to, as Daryl eloquently said, about common sense with respect to lending practices. I remember being at the first small business lending summit in Washington that the IFA was behind, and I remember some heated discussion between John Luther and of Duncan Brandt at the time, and one of the panelists from one of the major banks, I believe it was. It was pretty heated. I mean, I know John's face got real red and got red under the collar about it. It was just a lot of finger pointing, and I just think that. And I'm happy to see that over the last couple of years, I think a lot of effort has been made to close this gap between, you know, franchise ownership and the small business lending community, meaning that the small business lending community is finally learning more about franchising, because I know back in the day you showed them, at the time, a UFOC, and they looked at it like, what's that? Where now, obviously, it's become an integral component of the lending process. So I'm happy to see that the education is occurring, and certainly kudos to the IFA for their continued efforts with respect to small business lending.
Well, thank you very much, Paul. And I know the hard work, you know, and that's handled from the top down from Steve.
Absolutely.
And also our federal folks, Jay Perrin and Judith Thorman, and also, you know, our media folks as well, of this getting that message out there. And the thing of it is, and it's lobbying 101 or advocacy 101, if you will, is in order for them to like you, they have to know you. And then the more they know you, hopefully they'll like you more. And that's what we're trying to do with small business lending, is they're going, well, okay, we understand how you operate. And hopefully we can get some of, you know, loosen up some of those purse strings, if you will, for just the lending. You know, it's not a handout. It is an actual loan. So, and hopefully we can do that, and we can get more people employed, and that helps everyone out there.
Sure does. And I appreciate you mentioning, you know, some of the other names that are definitely front and center when it comes to political issues and activity. But a lot of people in the franchisor community don't know Dean Heil, don't know Judith, and don't know the other people that are so instrumental on the political side. And so my call to action to the IFA is, you know, hey, guys, I know you're front and center on certain events. I'd love to see you guys in the booth at the IFA convention in New Orleans so we can get to know you on a personal basis. I think we'd appreciate it a lot more, and certainly be able to extend a hand and give you our absolute sincere thanks.
Well, you know, I've never been afraid of self-promotion, Paul, so I'd be happy to be out there talking with folks at the booth. So I'll take you up on that.
Sounds great. Okay, so you mentioned some of the state legislation. You mentioned some of the, you know, particular around franchise relationships. And I know there's a lot going on in California. There's been a lot of recent news about it. If you could highlight some of the key states and what's going on a state-by-state basis, that's kind of front and center at this point.
Sure, and we'll start out with, like, the franchise relationship bills. We had Assembly Bill 1141 introduced earlier this year. It was a retread of last year's Assembly Bill 2305, which at that time was the worst piece of franchise legislation that we had seen ever. And 2305, as you know, died in committee last year. And then 1141 was brought up this year. And it was really just more of a bill that should have never been, I guess, would be the best way from our position on that, is that it was content-wise mirrored image of 2305, and then it was amended, scaled back down due to the concerns that IFA raised, and now it's been put on as a two-year study bill, and it could come up again, but hopefully it won't. I think the more people were informed about the damaging aspects of the bill, its chances of moving forward have been decreased, at least in its current form. But we hopefully that bill won't resurface again. But we also have a very interesting bill and a very challenging bill and detrimental bill, and that's Senate Bill 610. And it's a very short bill talking about good faith being incorporated as a statutory definition into contracts and allowing for franchisees to sue franchisors on the basis of a good faith claim. Now, on its surface, that sounds like a really good idea. Who could be against good faith? However, the problem right. that lies in this is that with a statutory definition, good faith, this isn't a fungible term that you can throw in there and just say, okay, we now have good faith. The way this bill is written, it would undermine the franchise agreement that exists between franchisees and franchisors. And what would it allow is any time a franchisee views that their franchise agreement's terms, even those terms that they've been agreed to, were outside what would be accepted as good faith, it gives them an opportunity to sue. Now, the downside of this for franchisees is this. You have a franchisor who believes a franchisee is not living up to the standards agreed to on a franchise agreement, that franchisor may be put into a position of saying, look, it's not worth the litigation cost for me to go to court on this potentially from the franchisee perspective because they're afraid of a franchisee lawsuit to enforce some of those standards. Well, then what happens is the brand integrity begins to erode because the franchisor mm-hmm. even though they believe they may be right, and they probably are in certain circumstances, they won't be able to enforce the brand integrity standards that are crucial for all franchisees. And so that's why we're really concerned about Senate Bill 610. Now, it passed the Senate, and when I say passed, it squeaked out of the Senate. It came on a 22-12 vote. It needed 21 votes to make it across. Now, the advantage that we have is that the Assembly is an area that we are hoping that we'll be able to have a dual referral onto the committees, the Judiciary Committee and also the Business and Professions. And even if we don't get that dual referral, we are still confident that the more the legislature learns about this bill, the more concerned they will be about it. Now, you know, some folks said, well, it had bipartisan support when it passed the Senate. Well, I'd also like to say it had bipartisan opposition as well, because of the 12 folks who voted against it, there were Republicans and there were also Democrats. And we plan to take the fight onto the Assembly. We plan to vigorously educate all the members of the Assembly, starting with whatever committee it's assigned to first, and we plan to slog it out all the way through. And I think in the end we will be victorious on that because we have the facts on our side. And once you sit down with a legislator and their staff, the education aspect of it, they do understand just how detrimental this legislation would be if it passed. So that's California. Then we had Maine, if I could go on to talk about that.
Sure.
This was LD 1458. Now, I said 2305 was the worst bill that we had seen before. Well, 1458 is, not to use an overused phrase, but it wasn't on steroids, as my one of my colleagues here said. 1458 is this bill on meth. It was a bill that is just way outside beyond the pale of what would be, as far as franchise relationship. It covered almost every bad piece of legislation that's out there as far as franchise relationship legislation, and it took it to such an extreme, and I can just hit some of the lowlights, if you will, of this legislation. Once again, it had, you must treat every franchisee equally or identically. Well, take, for example, the franchisees that were hit by Hurricane Sandy. You know, you wouldn't mm-hmm. be able to give a pass on them saying, well, look, okay, your royalty fees this month, you got hit by a hurricane, we're going to cut your break. Nope, couldn't do that because you could be sued by individual franchisees. You also the aspect of it allowing franchisees to choose their own vendors is very problematic. Now, you think, okay, why is this such a problem? Take, for example, the food service industry, where you have food items. Now, let's suppose you have a piece of a hamburger meat or carrots, whatever, anything that you're consuming, and for some reason it's been contaminated, E. coli, salmonella, what have you. You don't know as a franchisor if there's an outbreak or an incident like that, is this something that's located only to one retail establishment, or is this a system-wide program? Now, even going beyond, let's suppose people aren't getting sick from whatever they eat. Let's suppose the pickles on their sandwich taste, they're perfectly fine pickles, but they taste different. Well, part of the experience and why franchises are successful is the consistent experience. Now, if I eat some sandwich and I find these pickles not to be tasting the same as other pickles, I am not getting the same product that I was expecting, and that's going to hurt the brand. And what this bill really did, and what happened is the bill has been put over to a carryover, and we plan to, you know, work. Our goal is that no legislation is necessary. But what this bill really would have done, had it been enacted, it would have hurt the franchisee who plays by the rules and expects the franchisor to enforce the brand and keep that brand standard. Because when you invest in a franchise, you invest into a system that you know that works, and you know that there's this consistent experience that everybody knows what's going to happen when you purchase an item or if you stay in a hotel or what have you. It's a consistent experience every single time. That's the goal of having a franchise, and it's a positive experience. Well, what this bill would do is would basically create anarchy, because you wouldn't know what products you're getting. They had issues in this bill that would have allowed the franchisees to set their own hours. They could set the products that they sell. They could decide whether or not to participate in a promotion. And what happens is you have an individual, the franchisee, who says, okay, I'm buying into this system. I understand the rules. I signed the agreement. I read the agreement. And now other folks who are in the system aren't playing by the same rules. And those are the folks who really would have been hurt by that. So luckily, the bill's been put over to carryover. We plan to take that time to educate legislators, and hopefully there won't be legislation in Maine because we don't believe that that's necessary and that, once again, governmental intervention is this something that shouldn't be involved between franchisees and franchisors. We have another bill, Senate Bill 73 in Massachusetts, that's been reintroduced. We had a series of discussions with legislators who decided that legislation wasn't needed by that task force that was formed. However, the same senator that introduced this bill previously has introduced this bill again, this time beefed up a little bit more, and hopefully we'll be able to convince the legislators during the committee hearing that that bill isn't needed as well. And that's pretty much it for franchise relationship legislation. I'm more than happy to talk about some of the more interesting other interesting bills out there as well, if we have time.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly the one in Nevada with the fat tax, I think is definitely worth mentioning.
Well, you know, this is if I had to pick a favorite bill, I would say this is one of mine. This is the Nevada bill, Assembly Bill 122. And what this bill would have done, Paul, is it would have assessed a 5-cent tax on any food item that contained more than 500 calories. Now, the food aren't determined whether or not it's protein or whatever. It was this 500 calories. And it only focused on fast food restaurants. So if you had the formal sit-down restaurant, or if you had a grocery store, or if you had a convenience store or a gas station, what have you, it didn't apply to any of them. It only applied to the quick service restaurants, if you will. And so I'm on the plane. I land in Las Vegas. We were at the convention. Matt Heller, who handles a lot of our media, calls me up and he said, Dean, you know, we have a reporter that would like to talk to you about this bill. And I said, okay, I'm happy to do so. And I told the reporter I found that it to be a regressive tax. I said, look, in Nevada you have one of the highest unemployment rates, you have one of the highest foreclosure rates, and what you're doing is you're hitting people who are eating at fast food restaurants, who many times are members of the lower socioeconomic strata, who are just maybe working 2-3 jobs, driving into a fast food service restaurant, getting a meal, and then going to the next job. I think this is the worst bill out there possible. Well, what happened then is we had the TV crew, and as this one individual said, I had my 5 minutes of fame on TV talking about regressive taxation and the like, and it was great to talk about that. I really enjoyed it, talking with folks and getting the message out. Took the clip, sent it to my folks. My mom thought it was cool that I was on TV. However, my dad, who is a little bit more cynical about things, he said, you know, kid, if you're talking about a fat tax, you might want to lose a few pounds before you go on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's always that, you know, bring you back down to reality aspect of it. But it was an interesting bill. The bill died in committee, thankfully, and that was that for that piece of legislation that should have probably never been. But we have other bills as well beyond this franchise relationship. We have bills like in Minnesota that would have eroded non-compete agreements, which are very important to the franchising world.
Sure.
We have sales reporting bills. New York has a current law that requires franchisors to report back to the Department of Revenue the returns that they get from the sales report of their franchisees. Now, as far as I know, nothing's ever come of that, any additional revenue. But other states, you know, the thing is that they're looking to get any budget dust they can by shaking the coins. And so even if it's ineffective, they're still going to try it. But the problem is it's ineffective. It's a burden on the franchisor. It's a burden on the franchisee. And at the end of the day, it doesn't do anything. So why do it in the first place? And, you know, I understand the need for revenue, but let's do things that will actually raise revenue rather than this causing an administrative burden on folks. And so IFA
sure.
is fighting that. Sometimes I hate to say it, but, you know, I'm a vehement advocate for the way things are, and, you know, or maybe for this the status quo. And if we can just have legislation that only helps our companies and also our franchisees, that would be my ideal world. Unfortunately, I spent a lot of time just stopping bad bills that would have a very detrimental effect to both franchisees and franchisors.
Sure, it's the whole reactive versus proactive type of situation that we're often pushed into. Well, I first have to say, hey, Dean's dad, TV does add 10 pounds. I know that all too well. Hey, Dean, I really appreciate you being my guest today. I know you just got back from an international trip, and so I appreciate you being here today and appreciate all that you and the IFA does on behalf of franchising. Thanks again.
You bet, Paul. Anytime.
Next week, as we leave the legal series, we're in our franchise model series, which will be through the month of June. Next week, we'll be talking consumer marketing with Ed Waller, the co-founder of CertaPro, and the 2012 chair of the Franchise Consumer Marketing Conference, which Steve Olson told us about earlier in today's show. Then the following week, Mary Thompson from Mr. Reuter and the Dwyer Group and a recent award winner of the Body Levine Award will be my guest, and we'll be talking operations and franchise relations. June 20th, Robert Stidham of Franchise Dynamics will be my guest, and we'll talk about franchise sales and development. And we'll wrap up the month of June on June 27th with Amit Mecha from FranConnect, and we'll be discussing technology in franchising. And, of course, that will start next week. Again, I want to thank all my great guests through this fourth annual legal series, Mike Lehold, Lee Plave, Amy Chang, Barry Heller, Mark Burt, Lane Fisher, Jonathan Redgrave, and today, Dean Heil. Just a tremendous amount of time and effort given voluntarily to Franchise Today so that we can get the word out to the franchise community about best practices from a legal standpoint. Just a tremendous fourth annual Franchise Legal Series. Can't wait till next year. I could actually see us expanding it to 10 segments next year. So next week, again, June 6th, Consumer Marketing with Ed Waller as my guest. Until then, my name is Paul Segreto, wishing you the best, the very best in this great, great, great thing we call franchising. Franchise Today is out.